This is KUT Weekend for the last weekend of January 2016. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier. Here's what we got for you this week. Why is Austin the only fast-growing city with an African-American population that's shrinking?
Latinos, Asians, whites all grew, and African-Americans saw an absolute decline.
How the Austin School District's transfer policy has some parents talking about leaving AISD.
We're looking at selling our home. We're looking at moving to Cedar Park or Leander. We're looking at homeschooling.
And a review of a new Italian restaurant on East Cesar Chavez.
I had an ominous feeling before the dinner started, and I was wrong.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend. But first, a reminder to subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org. If you go there, you'll find links to iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and RSS feeds. If you can, please leave us a review in the Apple Podcasts app or in the iTunes store. And if you have any questions, you can email news@kut.org. You can contact me directly, nathan@kut.org. You can also follow me on Twitter if you want. I'm @KUTNathan. The Austin City Council adopted an ordinance to regulate ride-hailing apps such as Uber and Lyft yesterday, and joining us to help clarify some of those regulations and what they mean is Austin Mayor Steve Adler. Thanks for your time, sir.
Well, thanks. It's good to be invited back on.
Can you help me understand this about the ordinance? The measure is voluntary for drivers of transportation network companies, ride-hailing apps, Uber and Lyft, to get fingerprinted. That's the idea, is that it's voluntary and there are incentives. But those who decline to get fingerprinted are, in a sense, punished by being restricted. And I know the details still have to be worked out, but there will be restrictions on where they can operate, perhaps when they can operate. So isn't it more of a restriction than an incentive?
Absolutely not true. The ordinance very specifically provides that with respect to any rewards that we would be giving to drivers that volunteer to support their community, that any rewards would not diminish the access that to any rideshare driver that they have today. And I think that's real important, and something that Uber and Lyft are not saying. But it very specifically contains language that says that any right, any ability, any access that a driver currently has will not be taken away. So what we're talking about is providing access to new areas or new opportunities. And I quote, "The incentives in this section shall not be construed to deny access by a driver who is not a badge holder to a legally accessible area that was available to a transportation network company driver as of today." So for example, let's look here at Austin City Limits. Austin City Limits, the question is, to the degree feasible and done in a way that does not deny any TNC driver anything that they had before, is their ability to give badged drivers preferred access at Austin City Limits? And the answer to that is yes. Because right now, Austin City Limits has streets that are fenced off and barricaded, and no one gets into them. There are some areas that are available to taxi drivers that have never been available to TNC drivers. They've had to queue in space, you know, across the river over at Austin High.
Right. And that would be within the hours established by the directors, and that would apply to that preferred pickup location at a large event.
Right. And that would, again, be something that they don't have today.
Part of the Thumbs Up program would involve, I guess, a badge within the app itself to indicate that a driver had had undergone a fingerprint-based background check?
Well, only to the degree that somebody who's running an app wanted to put it there.
It doesn't seem like they want to put it there.
Well, Get Me says that they'll put it there. So I imagine that some app people will put it there and some app people won't put it there. But we're certainly not requiring any app company to do it.
But how would it work if Uber and Lyft, who don't seem amenable to this ordinance, I mean, if they don't want to play ball, then how would I know that my driver has undergone a fingerprint-based background check?
Those details haven't all been worked out, but one possibility would be to put a sticker on a car.
But by that point, the car's already arrived. I've already requested it. I've already hired it, in essence.
It's too late at that point, isn't it, to tell? Don't you want to know before you order the driver?
You do, and you're designing the badge in a perfect world where everybody's cooperating, and in that world, that happens. My understanding is that you'll be able to do that with GetMe, so that somebody who wants to be able to tell that and know will be able to see it. Certainly, we can't force or make Uber or Lyft do that, but you can also do that physically. For example, right now, TNCs are not allowed to queue and wait in the airport. And one of the things that's possible is to give volunteering drivers the ability to queue and wait at the airport. You could have an attendant that was, you know, letting people in line to the degree that they had that certification. You could have a crossbar that went up and down depending on whether someone came in and had that sticker on their car or that card in their wallet. There are lots of different ways that could work.
Why go through all this effort? As Councilmember Delia Garza asked on the dais yesterday before the vote, why devote all this time and city resources and political capital to passing an ordinance that could be moot if the ordinance brought to council by supporters of Uber and Lyft, along with the 65,000 signatures that force you to consider it or put it to a public vote if you don't adopt it? Why go through this process before that plays out, because it might wind up canceling this ordinance?
I mean, one, we were already moving forward with this voluntary program before the petition event started, because it was the right thing to do. And as I said in December, I did not and do not think that a mandatory fingerprinting program is the right policy for the city of Austin. And I anticipated in December that would be made clear in January, and I would hope that we still do that. We're continuing to go about our governance of the city the way that we were doing it. Now, people have filed a petition, and I think that it's real important for city government to be responsive to that. And we'll sit down next week and see what the differences are between what is the initiative that came with the signatures, the differences between that and the ordinance rules that we would otherwise have without that.
Well, Mayor Adler, I really appreciate your time today. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend.
All right, Nathan, take care. Bye-bye.
One tech company that could administer the badge program set up shop at City Hall this week. KUT's Audrey McGlinchey took a look around.
Meet Blake Hall, co-founder of a company called ID.me.
Yeah, so right now we're in the Austin City Hall, and we're here today to demonstrate what a voluntary driver enrollment into what Austin is calling their Thumbs Up program, which would be the Austin City administered criminal background sex offender check.
Hall stands in front of an iPad attached to, for lack of a better word, a pole. He tells me if the city gives them the go-ahead, they'll set these iPads up at high traffic areas in the city, and you can enter a bunch of personal data that the city can use to run a background check.
The first screen will prompt you to enter your email address and your phone number.
All right, audrey@kut.org. I'll save my phone number for my friends. Next screen.
It's their name, their address, their driver's license number, all the things that would be used to identify that driver uniquely. But since typing is never fun on a mobile device, they can actually scan their driver's license.
So all right, here's my New York State license. I really need to get a Texas one. Name, Audrey McGlinchey. Address, not safe for air. Driver's license number, sorry,
so
listeners. Next screen.
The next step is actually fingerprint collection. So there'll either be, depending on cost and what the city decides, a full 10-print collection slap where you can collect 4 fingerprints at a time. Or a single digit where you go through kind of digit by digit until all 10 have been collected.
Thumb, index, right. Middle, ring, you get the idea. Next screen.
And they would also have to take a selfie because that's you need to submit a picture along with the check.
Cheese. Next screen.
So unlike the DMV, if you don't like your photo, you can retake it. If you do like your photo, you have the option to accept it. So that's on the next screen.
I look good. Next screen.
You're done. So the point here is at the end, if you're a known good actor, maybe you've already been screened by the city government or as a taxi cab driver or a chauffeur, you would immediately get a notification that you're eligible, that Thumbs Up is going to be mailing you some trust marks. You would get a digital
login.
Now,
it's still unclear how a middleman like ID.me would note the successful background check on ride-hailing apps such as Uber and Lyft. Hall says his company has worked in some capacity with these companies in the past, but won't tell me more. That negotiation would be left up to the city. Of course, it's not even clear if this system will happen at all. If Uber and Lyft are successful in their effort to pass their own version of ride-hailing regulations, fingerprinting drivers might never be necessary. Audra McGlinchey, KUT News.
So a few weeks ago, we launched a project where we get you to tell us what you want to know about Austin. Could be anything. Let us investigate something. Tell us what you want us to take a look at. And then we get a ton of submissions. So we narrow it down so that people can vote on it on our website, KUT.org. And we call this project AT Explained. ATX Explained, put together, AT Explained. It's a good hashtag. Anyway, the story the voters chose for our first round is about Austin's African-American population, specifically why it's shrinking even as every other demographic group in the city is growing. KUT's Mose Bouchel looked into it.
Ellen Sweets used to be on KUT's advisory board, but not anymore. You're on the road, right? What are you doing?
Yeah, we're driving along. I'm watching, looking at orchards, and skies cleared up a little bit.
She left us to start a new life in Northern California. She was driving with her brother when I talked to her.
I feel a little, hold on a second, look at that rainbow. I'm seeing a rainbow. See it?
But you're actually seeing a rainbow right now as you're talking about it.
I had to point that out to my brother.
That sounds like a pretty
auspicious omen. Yes.
Sweets left Austin for a lot of reasons, but her experience of race here played a part. She says living here as an African-American woman, it just started to feel like too much work. She even wrote an essay about it before she left.
Austin has a measure of unjustifiable self-satisfaction with itself these days. It's not me. And at my age, I don't feel like putting up with anything anymore.
She is not alone. Thousands of Black Austinites have said goodbye in recent years, and that led to a question.
Why is Austin the only city in the country that's experiencing a percentage decline of our African-American population?
Jen O'Neill is the listener who submitted the question, our first AT Explained story.
I am currently a student at Southwestern University.
Is it strange that I wondered whether the person who asked this question would be white or black?
No, it's not strange at all.
And here we are, two white people.
Yeah.
Talking about race.
So. Yeah. I think I even read an article recently. I forget who it was by, but it was like the whiteness of public radio.
That sounds like a good story too. But first, this one.
There is one clarification to my question we have to make.
Yes. The fact is that a surprising number of U.S. cities are experiencing a decline in their African-American populations.
Washington, D.C., Chicago, Detroit.
Eric Tang is a UT professor who studies this trend. And he says what makes Austin different is that it's a fast-growing city.
And its growth between 2000 and 2010 was a staggering 20.4%. So if you took all cities that fit that category, all of them saw a simultaneous growth in African-Americans. There was one exception, and that was Austin.
Austin's Black population dropped by about 4,000 between 2000 and 2010.
In the middle of tremendous growth, that just doesn't happen. It doesn't make sense.
And tremendous growth across, if I'm not mistaken, almost every other demographic.
Exactly. Latinos, Asians, whites all grew, and African Americans saw an absolute decline.
And that trend continues. A lot of the people who leave still live near Austin, but the population shift flies in the face of the city's well-cultivated image of an inclusive kind of town. Here's Jen O'Neill again.
Like, if you want to be white and just do your own little white thing in your own little white world, I don't know. I don't think I want that to be the city.
So to figure out how we got here, let's start with a little history. I'm standing at the corner of 9th and Neches Streets, downtown Austin. There's a Holiday Inn across the street from me. Next to that, there's a big pit in the ground where they're building another hotel. But if I was here 100 years ago, I would be near the site of the Wesley United Methodist Church. That was a church built by a congregation of freed slaves in 1867. It stood here until 1929. Then the church moved here to the much quieter corner of Hackberry Street and San Bernard, east of what is now I-35. There's an historic marker in front of this church that mentions the move, but what it doesn't describe is what was happening in Austin at that time. In 1928, the city of Austin wrote up a master plan to cement lines of segregation. It pushed Black and Hispanic people to the east side. Before that, Black Austinites lived in little enclaves around town. But by 1930, 80% of Austin's African-American community was on the east side,
where our churches and stores and businesses were. It was the hub center for African-Americans.
Reverend Sylvester Chase Jr. is the senior pastor at Wesley United Methodist. He says it was still like that when he arrived here 21 years ago.
I didn't see white people. Hardly ever saw you. You didn't cross 35. I'm talking about white people.
But over the last 15 years or so, all that's changed. White people, many of them new to town, started moving east of the highway. In full disclosure, I was one of them.
Now, everybody's flocking to the east side. Whites from all across the nation are coming to the east side. I think they finally decided we have gone west, we have gone north, we have gone south, now we got to come east.
So here's a big part of the answer. Because Austin's Black community was so segregated historically, it felt the impacts of gentrification more severely. A small part of town that had been designated for African Americans became the center of a real estate boom. Taxes are up, along with cost of living. Longtime residents are moving out.
All right, so what happens to this church then? I mean, what's the future?
It might not be a future at this location.
Are you looking at other locations?
We're not looking. But you say, well, there's a future. I'm just saying at this location, it's just like businesses. Sometimes you have to relocate.
And that's where the story could end. But not this time.
The only time I see Black people in the news in Austin, I don't want it to always be talking about, well, woe is me, there are not enough of us here. I think that does something psychologically, even if it's, you know, unconscious, to my white peers or counterparts, that is the only worthy conversation to be associated with the Black community.
Virginia Cumberbatch is a native Austinite. She's Black, and among many other things, she works in marketing and public relations. And that informs her take on this question. Cumberbatch says, yes, it's important to address the economic realities that are pushing people out. But while we do that, we should recognize the contributions of people that are here.
We're putting together, you know, our top 10 list of people to watch, or we're putting together, you know, 5 stylish people, and all the people on that list are white. Then what is my understanding of what Austin represents? It's white culture.
So on top of everything else, it's a PR problem. Austin has shown itself to be good at PR.
Exactly.
Selling itself.
Oh, yeah. The city has no trouble. I mean, I think there was one year where we were like on every top 10 list.
Or to put it another way, as the city loses longtime Black residents, is it doing anything to attract new ones? She says she just talked to a friend on the East Coast who happens to be Black. He's thinking about moving here. A lot of this stuff came up in their conversation. We started this story with someone who is leaving, so I thought I'd give him a call.
Who are you with?
Yeah, that is a fair question. Elijah Williams lives in Washington, D.C. with his wife. And they're looking to move in a year, and Austin's on the short list. He likes the job market here. He likes the laid-back reputation, the outdoorsiness.
Just a good city where we can enjoy ourselves and have fun, sort of newlyweds, but also as future parents.
But he's weighing it against other places that have larger and more visible Black populations, like Houston.
I do also value the opportunity to sort of coalesce around, you know, folks that look like me from time to time.
He says finding that will be more work in Austin. It's not a deal breaker, but he says it's an important thing to think about. Moses Bouchel, KET News.
So I'm sitting outside here with Moes. How you doing, Moes? Nice day out, eh?
It's beautiful out here. Thanks for deciding to do this outside.
You said there's a lot that didn't make it into your story.
There always is, but especially with this piece, I felt like there were issues that I just didn't have the time to delve into that hopefully, you know, I know we will keep reporting on, so that's good.
Like what?
Well, I mean, the policy angle to the whole thing. You know, how much is this city really doing to try to reverse some of the trends we're talking about, the gentrification we're talking about, the question of affordability? Are there city policies that are actually encouraging this kind of thing? You know, as we bring in new companies and new workforce, that's part of the trend that's pricing other people out. So some of that kind of nitty-gritty is stuff that's really ripe for further coverage.
Yeah, for sure. It seems like the city's been trying to address affordability. A lot of the city council members won their election campaigns on a platform of that, but not really much has changed affordability-wise. Median home prices are still trending upward, and I guess there's a lot to explore.
Absolutely, even what we consider to be affordable. I mean, like, even when we talk about a house or an apartment unit that might be affordable, still out of reach for a lot of people.
And I love the discussion about Austin's public relations machine and how that might be used for greater good to address, you know, the declining African American population.
It was an angle that had never occurred to me before, but we are a city that really kind of puts out an image of itself, and that's part of our success, right? And that's part of the reason people want to move here. But how much is that an image of a, frankly, like a white city? You know, I think a lot of people I spoke with said that that is kind of what the image is, and that's something to be aware of. You know, it's an important thing to think about.
Well, I enjoyed your story, Mose. Thanks for talking to me about it.
Thank you, Nathan.
Some parents say they're concerned that the Austin School District's new student transfer policy might force them to leave the district or even leave Austin altogether. After this fall, siblings will not be allowed to transfer automatically to a school that their brother or sister attended if it's overcrowded. KUT's Kate McGee has that story.
Amy Schaefer and her family live one block out of the attendance zone for Gillette Elementary School in North Austin. When her oldest son was in kindergarten, they decided to ask for a transfer to Gillette.
And it was just the kind of environment that we wanted our children to go to school in. At our home school, the kids are bused in, they're not from the neighborhood, and so it was important to us that we have that kind of active and involved community.
Schaefer's second son transferred to Gillette because his brother went to the school. But under AISD's new policy, which goes in effect in the 2017-2018 school year, their 19-month-old sister won't be able to automatically attend Gillette if it continues to be overcrowded. Now, Schaefer says she and her family are considering their options.
We're looking at selling our home. We're looking at moving to Cedar Park or Leander. We're looking at homeschooling, private schools, charter schools, and all options are on the table.
Betty Sanchez has three children at Gillette, plus a two-year-old. She's worried about her oldest child. Under the old policy, if you transferred into an elementary school, you could automatically attend the middle school that elementary school fed into. In Sanchez's case, that's Lamar Middle School. But in 2017, that won't be allowed at overcrowded schools. Sanchez says she can't afford to move into the neighborhood to keep him at his current school.
We can't even afford the apartments nearby. The best we could do is a one bedroom.
I watch this neighborhood like a hawk, and I keep waiting for that deal. And those deals are $400,000 for a teardown and $500,000 for a home that needs work. And I'm priced out of that.
That's Kim Mitchell, who transferred her children to Gillette from East Austin. Under the changes, she's worried her kids won't be able to continue middle and high school with their peers. Mitchell says the only thing that's kept her family in Austin are the good schools.
We can't pull them out, but if we're forced to pull them out and not keep them with their peers, why not start over out in the country where it is more affordable?
Last year, the school board gave Superintendent Paul Cruz more autonomy to close a school to transfers if there isn't enough space. Last month, he announced those changes at a school board meeting.
Beginning with the 2017-2018 school year, all priority transfers will be limited to schools that have space available.
During that meeting, specific changes to the sibling transfer policy weren't mentioned. Families will still be able to appeal to the district, but there's no longer a guarantee their child will be able to attend the same school as their siblings. Some school board members now say they're concerned the new policy may force more families out of AISD at a time when the district is trying to hold on to its students.
The intent is sort of to grandfather that out so you wouldn't have split families, because that doesn't work, right? I mean, that's just not going to work for families. You will have families that will actively seek to keep their families together.
That's school board president Kendall Pace. The grandfathering policy only lasts until next year. After our interview, Pace says she found the change very concerning. Vice President Paul Saldana says he's willing to revisit the conversation.
This may be a scenario in which there were unintended consequences, perhaps that we were not aware of, as we should have been when we enacted.
But Saldana says the district can't ignore AISD's reality.
You have schools that are under capacity, and you have schools that are overcrowded. And so where do you draw the line?
The district has lost 3,000 students since 2012 and is projected to lose more than 6,000 students over the next 10 years, 7% of the current student body. Kate McGee, KUT News.
Stop me if you've heard this story before. There's a new Italian restaurant in town, but it might not be what you think. Juniper in East Austin, it opened in the fall, and here to talk about it is Austin American Statesman restaurant critic Matthew Odom. Hi, Matthew.
Hey there, Nathan.
So where does Juniper fit into Austin's recent crush of Italian restaurants?
You know, we've had so many Italian restaurants, as you say, and the first dinner I was at Juniper, there's this really beautiful blue architectural detail that kind of curves over the bar, almost like a tube or a wave. And I kind of saw it as the wave of Italian restaurants crashing in Austin. And I had an ominous feeling before the dinner started. And I was wrong. It turns out this place is riding atop that wave. And it's not Italian exactly as you would think it. There's not primo and secondi. It's not pasta heavy. There's not pizzas. It's not red sauce Italian. They take their cues from the north of Italy. And there are expected Italian dishes, of course. There's pasta like a handmade pappardelle, which wove itself through this lush oxtail ragu.
What's a pappardelle?
Just a flat, broad pasta.
Okay.
And there's deconstructed tiramisu at dessert one night. There was a pistachio cannoli. So you get some expected Italian dishes, but they do unexpected things, too. There's sumptuous chicken liver mousse dotted with candied grapefruit. There was blue crab with a sunchoke cream. Even the cocktail list had some unexpected twists, like a wonderful tequila-based cocktail.
Okay, well, who's behind this restaurant?
The executive chef is a guy named Nick Yannis, and he is the former creative director at the Uchi Restaurant Group, which is kind of interesting. If you look, there are a few subtle nods, probably unintentionally, to Uchi. You have these wooden boards that some great oysters were brought out on one night, and that mousse I mentioned was smeared across a wood board. So that has the slight feel of Uchi to it. And there's a juniper tree painted or stenciled, I can't tell, on the wall at the restaurant, and almost kind of evokes the cherry blossom tree that you see on the wall at Uchi.
What else did you like food-wise?
There were some great pasta dishes. There was a plump pasta, a stuffed pasta with roasted cauliflower. It was capped by this bubble bath of brown butter foam on a plate drizzled with cherry emulsion, which was great. One of the best dishes I had this year were these supple shrimp that were draped with roasted tomatoes, and they sat atop this electric salsa verde that was given some added depth by an accompanying black garlic reduction. That was fantastic. Again, one of the best dishes I've had this year.
Sounds like a lot of labor and technique goes into these dishes. What's the price like?
You know, you would expect to pay probably about $75 per person, including a cocktail or two and dessert. As it follows this trend of Italian restaurants, it also follows this trend of small plate restaurants, which I think some people are a little wary of at this point. But they do it really well. All the plates feel like fair values. They are all nicely composed dishes. They're more than just one bite. So you're going to eat three or four dishes a person plus a cocktail or dessert, about $75 a person.
Okay. Anything that you did not like about it?
You know, the service was great. The ambiance was great. I loved most of the dishes. There were a few stumbles, and usually that had to do with balance. I'm an acid freak, but even for me, there was this citric rush of lemon curd and relish on a grilled broccolini dish that I wish had just a little more smoke to kind of mute that acidic glow. And there was too much salt and a ham-infused brodo that was layered with these rosy discs of turnips. Would have liked to pull back a little bit on the salt, but those are fairly minor quibbles.
What's a brodo? I'm so filled with questions today.
It's just a broth.
Okay. Well, it sounds like overall you did like the place.
Definitely. And I think it's a fun place to eat because you can kind of work your way through the menu. The plates are small, but they get a little bit bigger, as with these tender pink medallions of duck that were served with persimmon and pickled onions. And that's $15, and you get about a half dozen medallions there. And there was also a seared lamb belly that was complemented by smoked radish and real creamy, almost dissolving smoky ricotta. And that was $15. So that kind of gives you a sense of the price points on the dishes.
So the restaurant is Juniper. It's on East Cesar Chavez Street, just a couple blocks east of Robert E. Martinez. You can read the full review right now at Austin360.com or in Friday's print edition of the Austin American Statesman. Matthew Odom is the restaurant critic. Good talking to you again.
Always a pleasure, Nathan.
My friends, it's KUT Weekend for the last weekend of January 2016. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org. If you have any questions or comments, hit us up at news@kut.org. Our theme music is by RAC. Thanks again for listening. Have a great weekend. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 at kut.org. And then,